Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome, welcome. I feel as though we're a little low.
Are we?
Yes, it's the rain. It's just too gloomy. It's just too damp. So we're going to be talking about, by way of reminder, please remember there's rosary in the chapel after our session today. You're very welcome. And yeah, you know, by comparison, here's the fellow who needs to write in caps to make it legible otherwise. So I wanted to just remind us of some things that we talked about last time in 4 and get over here into 5. If you recall last time, chapter 4 is predominantly, or the first part of it, most of it is parables. And our Lord makes this very strange remark about teaching in parables so that they will not see, so they will not hear. And he's quoting Isaiah. And, of course, that's distressing for us because we think, whoa, isn't the idea of a parable that you're somehow making it clear? And in a way that is true, the parable is a means for teaching, but clearly it becomes a means for teaching once our Lord starts to give the interpretation. Even as apostles walk away from these parables and say, what does that mean? All that sower and seed stuff. So eventually, the meaning of the parables is unfolded. And eventually the apostles go forth and teach to everybody what it is that Jesus gave to them and initially just explained to them. But the point of what it is that Isaiah says, there's an expression that you sometimes run into in commentaries, and it's called judicial blindness. And that doesn't mean the judge is blind. It means that people who are hearers of Jesus are in a way prevented from learning what he's saying, but they're prevented by learning from their bad will. So that their inability to hear is a kind of judgment upon them. It's the way you talk about that, you know, sometimes there are bad things you do, and then there's something that comes after that's a punishment, or as we would say in sort of modern educated language, a consequence. There are some things that really are the result of your own action. I mean, they come right out of what it is that you chose to do. Like, you eat in an unhealthy way, and, you know, your body kind of fights back. Boom! You know, it's there isn't some kind of further thing. It's from the very choice or series of choices that you've made. And so, think back to Exodus, when Pharaoh chooses not to listen to Moses, and more importantly, to ignore the divine signs that are clearly coming through him. It's not just God who's hardening his heart, he's hardening his own heart. When Christ teaches and works signs in a way that shows that he's the Messiah, when there are people in the crowds who simply refuse to listen, okay, that their hearts are hard against them, then the parables, as it were, don't make sense to them. And they don't make sense because those hearers are not looking for them to make sense. Right? You see in the apostles that although they don't understand, they are eager to learn. And in that sense, the parables were a kind of trigger to wonder. They propose a mystery to you, but if your heart is in the right place, you want to understand. You are hungry to know. And with time, what grace will do is open those mysteries to you. But if your heart is simply closed, then you don't pursue it. It's just symbols, figurative language, right? There's nothing there for you to dive into and learn. Okay? And you know that's I think many people's experience with the Bible. The Bible is not a book that explains itself. It's not a self-explanatory book. It's not a book whose meaning or characters or purpose is obvious. And you can get fooled. When you turn it into sort of bedtime Bible stories, you can turn it into something that's sort of easily accessible and so on. But then chances are you're not quite conveying what's actually in the book. The book is a very mysterious book. Okay? But if your heart is in the right place, then what you say is, I don't understand it, but I want to understand it. And then you pursue it. But if your heart is not in the right place, then it's, bah, it doesn't make sense. Jewish hillbillies from 3,000 years ago writing this book. Why should I pay attention to it? Your heart will not be open. So please understand, when we talk about a kind of a judicial blindness, right? You know, close their ears so they will not hear. Close their eyes so they may not see. That is not, as it were, people who are open and now, right? God is somehow cursing them. These are people who are sentenced, if you like, in this way, precisely because they're not open, because their hearts are hard. Okay? And at the same time, we have to believe that God, in His mercy, gives everybody enough grace. Everybody's got enough grace to get more. So we're not Calvinists. We don't believe that somehow there's just a sort of a damned human race, and then God arbitrarily picks people out of that to save. And then there are other people who are just reprobates. You know, they never had a chance. Remember, in the Calvinist system, there is grace, but there's no free will. We're all totally depraved, and then there are people who are just selected. Okay? The Catholic system is that we're all wounded by sin, but we are all given enough light to get more. St. Alphonsus Liguori, by the way, is very good on this. I mean, we could speak very generally about everybody getting enough grace, but what does that look like? What would that be? And the way that St. Alphonsus Liguori identifies it is everybody has enough grace or enough light to pray for more. So in other words, everybody is given the grace to ask. Everybody is given the grace to ask. So so somebody who's, you know, they've grown up without any religion, they've grown up as an atheist, or they've grown up in a kind of a pagan or an animist or whatever religion that may be largely confused, God still gives them the grace to say, I don't feel as though I know you. Who are you? Show yourself to me, God. Right? In Hebrews, when the long catalog where it talks about how faith is necessary, the thing that St. Paul will say, it is necessary to, in coming to God, that you believe that He is and that He is a redeemer, that is, He is a rewarder. The very least that you would open your heart to there being a God and that you would seek Him. If you at least do that, then He can give you more. But the problem is that such is the hardness of the human heart, there are many people who just don't make it even that far. God is giving them. I mean, that's the thing that maybe can be distressing for us. We can look at people who they aren't people of faith, or they just seem to resist, and we can feel that, you know, that He's, God, you're just not giving them enough, or show them a miracle, do something in their lives. Because it's very distressing to us to think that He's actually doing that. He is. He is knocking on their hearts, and they won't answer. So we have to consider that, if you have a loving and merciful God, you can't look at people who just seem hardened and lost and assume that God isn't doing enough. God may be doing plenty. You know, that's part of judging, or, you know, the prohibition against judging, is that you really don't assume that you can sort of x-ray people's souls and hearts and know what God is doing inside them. And there'll be all sorts of things that are going on that you cannot see. Of course you cannot see, because it's going on, this is a drama going on inside their souls. Okay, so let's talk about some of these parables. We didn't actually get to the specifics of the parables. Verse 419, remember the setup of the parables. Here's the sower sowing seeds. By the way, he seems like a fairly careless sower. I mean, he just seems like he's throwing the stuff all over the place. He's getting these bargain bags of seeds at Menards or something that he doesn't seem to really pay attention to where it lands. But some of it lands on rocky ground, some of it lands on thorns, some of it lands on good soil. And notice how it's interpreted. Our Lord tells us the stuff that lands on rocky ground, it sprouts for a while, but then persecution comes, right, and the seed withers. So that's the way that faith is given, and now it encounters obstacles. So, you know, pushback, persecution, ridicule, maybe physical violence. And of course, when our Lord is explaining this, this is something that the apostles are all going to live. They're all going to undergo. This is what the early church is going to look like. Thorns, on the other hand, remember, these are the things that it sprouts up for a while, but these are like the cares of the world. So honors and riches and pleasure and things like that. And these, they don't, the seed doesn't wither, it gets choked. That's the expressions it uses. It gets choked. So, in other words, the faith is something that it can wither in some people because the pressure is just too great. You know, the ridicule or the scorn or outright persecution. Sometimes in others, the faith withers because their desires are too strong. Their desires for status or pleasure or wealth or the approval or whatnot. Okay? So these are, if you like, your sort of negative incentives. These are your sort of positive incentives. Mark adds, you know, there's wealth and things of the world, and Mark adds this desires more generally. His way of phrasing it is more general. I think in Matthew it's sort of money, but he makes it more, so you could think of pleasure and, you know, and all of those things as falling under that. And then some of it lands on the good soil and it sprouts and it's fruitful. Remember that when it began by him talking about the mysteries of the kingdom. So what he's trying to help you understand is how it is that grace works in the world. Right? More generally, how does grace work in the world? God is distributing this grace. I was sort of making fun of the sower a minute ago by throwing the seed all over the place. But in a way, that's the picture you need of God. God is liberally distributing graces in souls and hearts. He's throwing it all over the place. But then the question always is, how responsive is the soul to what God is giving? Right? So one of the key ideas of a devout life, you know, one of the central things you're going to see over and over again if you read someone like St. Francis de Sales or Alphonsus Liguori, cooperation with grace. If you have the view that the human heart is totally depraved, then there's no such thing as cooperation with grace, right? Grace just takes you over. You are sort of like God's marionette, okay? He's just moving you on the strings because there's nothing in you that can respond to him. But the idea of cooperation with grace is that even though your will and your emotions are wounded by sin, there is still something left there to work with God. And the more that you do that, the more you are strengthened in the inside so that you are elevated as a human being, that you are divinized in some way. You know, that's the language of the Church Fathers, that as God in Jesus Christ takes on human nature, right? That God becomes man. The point of sanctification is that in some way man becomes God. Not God, substantially God, but God, that God is working in you, in his powers. He's elevating you to a supernatural life. Remember, that's the goal of the Christian life. It's a supernatural life. It's not just to be a decent person, a kind person. It's higher than that. It's much higher than that. You know, it's that in some way you are living a supernatural life. This line, of course, is distressing. To him who has, more will be given. To him who has not, he will lose the little that he has. And unfortunately, it's a line that I find myself using. It's the kind of thing as a teacher that you just see over and over again. The student who struggles, just doesn't want to talk to you and, you know, flees you. And then little Miss Perfect, who's already got a 94 in your class, comes in, what can I do to raise my grade? You know, you just want to take like some of her points, some of her, like her 99, and take 6 points and move it over to somebody else. Look, you got points banked. You've got points to spare. But so just in the natural order, where things are going well, because you have some kind of excellence, some kind of gift, then it just sort of piles on top of each other. You know, it just keeps growing and growing. Whereas when you don't have it somehow, it's just harder for it to happen and it's harder for you to keep it. Again, you know, this is the perspective I think you have as a teacher. You know, that you are gifted verbally. So, in other words, that you have a wide vocabulary, that you're able to look at complex sentence structure and kind of take that in. When you have those kind of abilities, your vocabulary just keeps growing exponentially. Whereas if you're the kind of kid that you just don't like books and you don't like reading and isn't there a movie of this? And it's all uphill for you. I think I've shared with you before. I mean, my boy was looking like he was sort of heading in that direction, you know, age 5 or 6, just not as keen on the books as the girls. I would get stacks of books from the library. You were reading them on the way to school. You were reading them on the way back. And, you know, and he resisted, but I didn't tell him this when he was 5 or 6, but certainly by the time he was in 3rd or 4th grade, I will not have you be struggling in the high school like many of these boys that I see struggling, because they just haven't ever really buckled down and gotten into the world of books. Books are these damn things you have to do at school, and that's it. Yeah, it is so much harder for you. There are just things in education are so much harder for you if that's your outlook. And after a while, it took. You know, my son will plow through books and enjoy books and talk about them. But that was not easy. You know, early on, that was all uphill. Again, that's the kind of thing that once you have it, or if you have it, your vocabulary grows, your reading comprehension grows, the way that you're able to interconnect subjects grow. All that happens. And again, when it doesn't, then it doesn't. and it's just harder. So it's not surprising that it's that way in the world of grace. It's not surprising that way in the world of grace. That there are things in a prayer life that the more you commit to it and embrace it, the more that it opens up. Just think about the difference in attitude between I'm going to Mass because I have to go to Mass, or I'm going to church because I have to go to church, versus just the attitude of, hey, this is the one day that I'm able to do so. Right? It could be in your schedule. You're simply not able to go to daily Mass. You're not able to do those things. And this is the one, you know, even that shift of attitude, that simply changes what it is you get out of the liturgy at that point. And there are so many people that one of my pastors used to call them hafta Catholics, H-A-F-T-A. Do I have to do this? Do I have to do that? And they're, I think it's just harder to hold on even to your faith if that's your outlook. C.S. Lewis has this wonderful line where he talks about people who do goodness the way that people pay their taxes. You know, that they give what they know they should, but they hope that there's this amount left over for them to just, you know, so there's like all this stuff they owe God, and they want to get that out of the way so that they can just enjoy themselves, like carve out my space away from God. Lewis says that if that's your outlook as a Christian, you are always going to be an unhappy Christian, because God is always going to be asking more from you than you ever want to pay. So that you need to change your outlook. You need to abandon the idea that you have any space at all and hand it all over to God. And then you'll get it back. But you'll be getting it back on terms that allow you to enjoy it. If you just try to carve out your space all the time, it'll never be enough for you, and you'll never be happy. I think it's Christopher Wordsworth in his commentary on Mark. He talks about you know, the in verse 26, remember, there's this sowing of the seed, and now it's not talking about the good stuff and bad stuff. He's talking about how it is that it comes up slowly. First there's this, then there's the, you know, there's the sheaf, there's the leaf, and so on. And it's trying to get us to understand the gradualness of grace. Very often we like the idea of sudden conversions. We like the idea of St. Paul getting knocked off his horse and boom, he's embracing it. That's very dramatic, but it's also very rare. Most of the time, conversion is something that is very gradual. Growth in grace is something that's very gradual. In fact, if you try to pay attention to your own spiritual growth, it won't happen. It will be like when you're lying in bed and you're trying to go to sleep and you're sitting there, I'm going to go to sleep. I'm so tired. I have to wake up early in the morning. I'm going to go to sleep. I'm going to sleep right now. You are not going to go to sleep if you sit there. But if you start thinking about other things and, you know, sort of relax and don't focus on the fact you need to fall asleep, then you'll be asleep. Okay. Likewise, if you're just focused on the duties of your state in life and having regular spiritual reading and being self-sacrificial and you know, mortifying yourself, giving up things regularly, you know, at the end of a certain time, you will realize that important changes have happened in you. But they will have happened while you are not looking at them. They will have happened to you unawares. Okay, and it can be the same thing with conversion, that there can be things happening inside a soul which are going on for several months and maybe years before they show themselves, before they show that there's some kind of a real change of heart or a real change of mind. My father, who was away from the church for 30 years, there would be these points where he would have conversations and it would kind of stick with him, and it wouldn't make an immediate, there wouldn't be some kind of immediate change. One of the ones that I remember is when we lived in Australia in the early 70s for about half a year. My father was doing research on Australian Aborigines. And at one point when he was out in the outback, he was visiting a sheep farmer. And the sheep farmer was a fundamentalist Christian. And, you know, my father is, of course, this cynical Berkeley-educated anthropologist, and they get to talking. And the sheep farmer, you know, very, very simple man. Maybe he made it through grade school and part of high school. But what, you think this all came out of nothing? What, it all came out random? Right? And you know, so he posed these really tough questions about, like, where the world came. So all the order and all the purpose and whatnot, it's just one accident after another. And my father walked away from that conversation with two things. He felt like he's just talking to this ignorant person who doesn't understand science. But on the other hand, that he's raising these questions that he wished he had a better answer to, and maybe he just needed to think about it more. But that stuck with him. That stuck with him. That he walked away from that conversation, and he should have been able to just, you know, body blow that guy to the ground. And it didn't. It didn't come off that way. And then years later, he would be involved in these discussion groups. It was a discussion group called the Wednesday Night Club. They called themselves the Wednesday Night Club, although they met on Thursdays. And the idea was they met on Thursdays to fool the liberals, because it was a conservative group, but it always divided into two, because there would be these conservatives who were kind of your libertarian, kind of fiscal conservatives, and then there would be your kind of conservative social conservatives. These were evangelicals and Catholics. And whatever the topic was, these two sets of people would end up arguing. It was very, very lively. And at the beginning of that, my father was kind of on that libertarian side. And he said, you know what, no matter what the topic, it always seemed to come back to, can you have morality without there being a God? Can you run society without there being some kind of religion? And of course, all the evangelicals and the Catholics would say, no, there has to be some kind of eternal law or natural law or moral code. The other guys would say, no, there's social utility, there's human rights, they would try that. And again, those were arguments that my father kept feeling as though he should be winning and wasn't. Okay? There was something very gradual going on in him. So that by the time he came back to the church in 1984, there had been probably about 15 years of buildup that at any point you would have said, this guy doesn't seem like he's getting any closer. But each one of those was steps. And again, for you, for the people in your lives who don't look like they're going anywhere, you know, you always have to hope that, in fact, there are these little steps, bit by bit, that are going on, that are just invisible to you, like the plants under the ground. At the very end of the chapter, there's a storm, and we get these lovely details in Mark that we don't get elsewhere. I've mentioned already that Mark adds that our Lord is on a pillow. He's like on a headrest. So he's got like a cushion that he's... And it's only in Mark that the apostles complain. Do you not care that we perish? So it's not just in Matthew you get the Lord save us, you know, this sort of plea from the heart. But in Mark, you know, evidently from Peter's eyewitness, Mark says, you know, like almost like, what's the matter with you? You're totally asleep. And notice how the two details fit together, that our Lord is very comfortable during the storm, and that the apostles are very upset to the point of complaining. A movie, by the way, that I saw recently that connects with this very nicely. This is one of these Italian neorealist movies. So this was made in, I want to say, late 40s or 50s. Luchino Visconti. And it's about La Terra Trema, is the name of the movie. The earth shakes, or the earth moves. And it's about fishermen on that would be the east coast of Sicily. So the side of Sicily that faces toward Italy. And these are guys who are, I guess they're fishing sardines, mostly sardines, and other small fish. And they're out all night with the nets and whatnot. And you realize, watching this movie from the 40s, these people are essentially fishing the same way that our Lord and the apostles were 2,000 years ago. The boats are the same kind of boats. And the work they're doing is the same kind of work. So if you think that, you know, when people describe you, well, in this age or in this day, you know, they were on the Sea of Galilee and they had very small boats and they had to stay very close to the shore, and, you know, and if they got in a storm, it could totally wreck the boat. That was true in the 1940s in Sicily. This isn't like something from ages and ages ago. And for all I know, it could still be true. There could still be those guys out there in these little rinky-dink boats fishing all night. And in La Terra Trema, in fact, what happens is the main character mortgages the house so that he can own his boat, so that he won't have to sell to the middlemen. And it's very stormy outside, but they need to keep going off to pay off the debt. So they're out there, and then they just get caught in the storm. And they don't come back, and they don't come back. And there's just this iconic picture of the mother and the sisters, and they're standing on the rocks looking out at the sea. You know, it's shot in black and white, in this beautiful black and white. And you see the wind whipping around. They all have, you know, kind of the dresses and veils and whatnot of the working class people in Italy. And you just see the wind whipping them, you know, as they're standing on these rocks, scanning the sea, looking for the boat, looking for their men. So this is something which, you know, it wasn't like ancient history. I mean, this is true well into the 20th century. Anyway, unlike La Terra Trema, the apostles wake up our Lord, and he rebukes the sea, and it stops. Okay, and of course, their response to that, quite understandably, who is this man that the wind and sea obey him? In a way, that's something that should take you right back to Exodus. When you think about the miracles that Moses works, you have to remember there's a kind of a cage match of the gods going on. The Egyptians worship a set of gods. These gods run the atmosphere, they run the environment, they run the, you know, the deserts and the plants and the animals and so on. And so for Moses to demonstrate that the God of the Israelites is in charge, those plagues are a series of attacks against these different provinces of the Egyptian gods. So the river, remember, the Nile is thought of as a god, and they turn it to blood, right? And frogs and gnats, those all fall under certain gods, right? The gods in charge of that too. even all the way up to causing darkness. Okay? Now you're interfering with the Ra, the sun god. Okay? For us, when we think of comparing religions, remember, we think of it in terms of things like human impact. We think of civilization. We think of outreach to the poor. We think of those kind of things when we compare religions. In the ancient world, can your God kick my God? Can your God beat my God? That's their way of thinking about it. And so it's a demonstration that this, the God of Israel, is the real God, that he controls all the elements in the atmosphere that are supposed to belong to the Egyptian gods. That's the demonstration that he is the real God. Remember, because they tend to think of gods as local, like there are those gods over there, and there are those gods over here, and that this God can strike the firstborn or cover the land with darkness or whatnot, that means he's running the whole show. That means he isn't just some sort of local God. He's, in fact, running the whole thing. So that echo is here when our Lord rebukes the wind and the sea. He's showing you, just like in Exodus, I control the elements. I control nature. That shows you that I am in charge. I have this little mark down here about Marduk and Tiamat. In Babylonian mythology, in the beginning, there's the sea. And it's all turmoil, and it's all out of control, because it's all being stirred up by this angry demon called Tiamat. And Tiamat is a dragon. And the opening of their creation story is that Marduk binds or conquers Tiamat and brings order out of this chaos. And there are some scholars that when they talk about Genesis, that picture, in a way, is kind of there in Genesis, that there's chaos at the beginning, you know, like the turbulent sea, and then God comes along and brings order. Okay, and you know, for Bible scholars, of course, what they're going to say is the Israelites are like plagiarizing Babylonian, but I would say the opposite. There's some reality, and that's, you know, there is this turbulence at the beginning somehow, which God brings order to, and that's, the Babylonians represent that in their way with this kind of Tiamat Marduk. But that you have this out of control sea, and now God comes along and brings order and stability. You know, there are kind of echoes in that in the end of this gospel. This is five over here. Are there things that I should say about four before we move to five? Okay. So this opens with the Gerasene demoniac, as he's named, because of this region of the Gerasenes. Remember, you're in a region that's not heavily Hebrew, that's not heavily Jewish, because and you can tell it because of the pigs. You know, they're farming pigs, which are not kosher, which are forbidden. You're among people who are not living a Jewish life, or may have some Jewish ancestry, but are not, you know, living the law, or they're not living as Jews. And I raised the issue before of, is Mark first, is Matthew first? Remember, one of the arguments for Mark being first is that it's shorter. And so if you're coming later, then it's longer, right? Things that are written later expand more. This is one of those moments where that theory kind of breaks down or runs into trouble. Because if you're comparing Matthew to Mark as a whole, yeah, you're right. Mark is 16 chapters, Matthew is 28. So Matthew is clearly longer. But once you start looking at different episodes, then you start seeing that when they cover the same ground, Mark tends to be longer, not Matthew. And this is evident in this episode right here. So the account of the Gerasene demoniacs, that goes on for 20 verses. And if you count them up, about 345 words. When you look at that same episode in Matthew, it's only 142 words. It's only about 6 or 7 verses. And then when you look at it at Luke is more comparable, but it's about 13, 14 verses, 307 words. So Mark's account is longer. And it looks in some ways like there's a lot there from Luke, but there are additions. So, for example, the Legion business, my name is Legion, for there are many of us. That is also in Luke. That's also in Luke. So perhaps that's in Luke first, and then that's something that's part of his account. But then there are other things which come out in Mark simply because he's giving more detail. It's longer. One potential disagreement. In Matthew, you're told there are two demoniacs. In Mark, you just have one. That's the kind of thing that if you're a Bible scholar, you can just go to town and say that there are two different accounts and they don't match each other. And so the story comes down in two different ways. And, you know, anyway, so then you kind of throw the factual question in doubt. But that's the kind of thing that Augustine will look at and say, you know, to say there's one doesn't deny that there's two. So Matthew, in his shorter account, talks about two of these guys, but Mark focuses in on this one guy as if there's sort of something special about him. So it doesn't deny that the other guy is there, but that's what he chooses to focus on. Again, when you have a family trip or some kind of outing or whatnot, compare the stories that you tell about that outing. You know, especially like if it's, let's say, you and your husband, where he focuses on certain things and you focus on others. And there may be parts of the account that are sort of contradictory, semi-contradictory, but it could be that there are just things that are just more interesting to you that come out that are not as interesting to him. A constant problem, in fact, that I have with my wife, I will call up a mutual friend of ours. They live in California, so we don't see them that often. And we went to graduate school together. We read a lot of the same books together. So we tend to talk shop. And I get off the phone and I talk to my wife. Oh, were you talking to Michael? Yes. Well, how are his children doing? Because we didn't talk about his children. We didn't talk about his children. We didn't talk about his wife. We didn't talk about anything that had to do with his family. All we talked about was shop. I only got 30 minutes to talk to this guy. We're just going to hit the philosophy stuff. And, of course, to my wife, that's completely incomprehensible. You're talking to somebody who's your friend. How are their children? Is he graduated now? Is it, you know? So that's not to deny that, you know, it's not as if my account somehow denies the account that she wants. But they're two different accounts. And if you put them together, you'd have a full picture. And that's the way you have to think of the Gospels, that you put this all together and you get a kind of a complete picture. But you don't want do we really want Gospels that say exactly the same thing? That starts to sound like a conspiracy. That sounds like collusion. If they really are independent witnesses, then there is going to be things that at the very least apparently conflict or emphasize some things to the detriment of others. Think about the characteristics of this demoniac. That he lives in the tombs, that he's wild, you know, he's strong. They try to enchain and imprison him, and it doesn't work. That he's howling. Here you have that he's crying out. I think it's in maybe it's in Luke where it talks about how almost making animal noises. And I don't know. One of the things that I wondered when I would read this account is, you know, what why are these the characteristics of a demoniac? Right. Well, why these? Why these traits? Why these behaviors? I think it's in Luke where he also talks about him being naked. Okay, that he's not clothed. Okay, and I think it's reading St. Thomas that St. Thomas points out that man is made to the image and likeness of God, and so when the devil takes possession of a soul, what he does is in a way create a parody of a human being. That he's mocking that image. Remember, the devil couldn't care less about, you know, animals, but human beings are somehow an animal that's been divinized, somehow an animal that's been given a pinch of the angel. And it's almost from a diabolic point of view, that is just repulsive. You know, it's one of the things I've been told by priests who carry out exorcisms is the most difficult thing about an exorcism is not the, you know, like changes in temperature or things that are moving around the room or things like that. Some of those sort of supernatural or disturbing things. It's the fact that you're in the presence of a will and intelligence that hates you. That hates you completely. All of us have been around people who, for whatever reason, just kind of take a dislike to us. Well, maybe not you. I mean, you're all very likable people. But certainly I have been in the presence of people who have really just taken... And you know how uncomfortable that is. It is really uncomfortable to be around somebody who clearly just kind of has just taken a dislike to you. And now amplify that. You know, that you have a being whose will and intelligence is vastly greater, vastly larger than yours, and hates you with every fiber of its being. You know, now why? When we read the Screwtape letters, that's one of the things that the sophomores, you know, it finally dawns on them. Well, why does he dislike us? Like, what have I ever done? You know, why would he dislike a, you know, chubby-cheeked, cheerful American kid like me? Why would the devil hate me? Because you are being offered something that the devil refused. You are being offered a happiness, a complete happiness in union with God. And that's what the devil refused, and the devil resents, you know, those who are united with God. They resent God, and they resent God's plan. So it's like the way, perhaps when you, those of you who had brothers and sisters that you, you know, played together when you were children, you know, your sister gets in trouble, you get in trouble. Now your goal is to get your sister in trouble, right? Your brother gets in trouble, or you get in trouble. Now your goal is to get your brother in trouble. You know, now why? I mean, getting them in the corner doesn't get you out of the corner. You know, getting them grounded doesn't get you out of being grounded. But that's what we call spite, right? That you resent the happiness that others have, even if taking it away doesn't somehow make you happier, doesn't get you more. The very fact that others have something that you don't, you resent it. Go ahead, Swati.
I'm curious. I've always wondered, because I've done a lot of Bible reading, but I've never seen that story of Lucifer and how, you know, he rejected God and that sort of thing.
Because it's not told to you. It's not revealed to you. I suppose God might say something like, it's none of your business. That's between me and him.
So no, I just wondered, how do we get that teaching? Do we get it?
So it's inference. For example, you're told in the Book of Wisdom, by the envy of the devil, sin entered the world. You know, so you're told that as a kind of a basic motive. Certainly diabolic pride. So in Jeremiah, you know, I will burst my bonds. I will not serve. That's where we get that sort of diabolic motto from. Chapter 1 of the book of Jeremiah. It's told in the place of a prince, kind of this enemy prince, but everybody's always stood that metaphorically to be the devil. Isaiah, Cyrus, I think it's the Prince Cyrus, I'm going to say chapter 24 in Isaiah, where you have ascended on high. You have swelled with pride. But you, O day star, you will be ground. You will be broken. You will fall to the ground, and so on. Remember, day star. The Latin word for day star is Lucifer. That's where we get the name Lucifer. Is from that passage and from Isaiah. So, it's from those kind of passages that you get the general idea that Satan's rebellion, Lucifer's rebellion, would be pride. Hubris. And you're told from wisdom that not only is he proud, but as so often is the case with proud people, that he's envious, that he resents human beings for what it is they have. And then from our narrative here, notice that after the evil spirits are expelled, they don't just want to go back to hell. You know, suffer us to go into the pigs. Okay? So evidently there's something, you know, the inference you draw from that is evil spirits are not free to operate as they would like. In other words, even though it seems to us sometimes as though the devil is just running the show out there, he operates under limits. He operates under restraints. And he's not just free to sort of roam when he pleases. Believe you me, however bad the world looks, it would look incalculably worse if the devil were actually given a completely free hand. Okay? If you're really given a free hand. So these devils are limited in how they can operate, and it seems like most of the time they are, you know, tormented in hell. They're not tormented physically. You can't take an evil spirit and burn it. But there's something about their intention or will that's frustrated by where they have to operate. So in other words, when you put a child in the corner, it's not like the corner itself is somehow painful. It's that you are there and you're not allowed to go anywhere else. You know, if you're like, you have to put yourself back to being 4 or 5 years old, and you know, you just can't stand being stuck there. By the way, as most of you have learned, that sending them to their room isn't really effective as a punishment. You probably would be better off with your teenager just putting them in the corner. The room is where they want to be. They may act all hurt that you sent them to their room. They have you right where they want you. You know, they want to be in their room. Room's a great place. So that the devils say, suffer us to go into the pigs. That means that even though these devils are miserable, they evidently get some satisfaction of at least operating in a place where they're not stuck, and they're at least inflicting some of their unhappiness on others. Okay, so I mean, that's the other thing that's plainly happening in this possession, is that you're sort of mocking the image and likeness of God. So this is not a man who can, as it were, think and choose and love. He's sort of reduced to a kind of animality. You know, the shamelessness of nudity, the antisociality of living in the tombs, the wildness of his of bursting his bonds such that he can't see sort of order and regularity in his own lives. He's mocking that image and likeness. But also that in doing so, it inflicts a kind of suffering on this man that is, for a devil, endlessly satisfying. There is something within us. You may think of yourself as a very nice person and be largely right, but it's hard not at times to enjoy the sufferings of others. If we think that suffering is in some way deserved, in some way we think they got it coming, or we just resent them, we just dislike them or whatnot, it's hard. But I think when we do that, when we you know, allow ourselves, or at some level, maybe beyond our notice, below our notice, that we do enjoy the sufferings of others, we do feel a little guilty about that. We know that's naughty. We know we shouldn't be doing that. With a devil, you're talking about a being that simply revels in the sufferings of others. He has no scruples and no pangs of conscience about that. He delights in the suffering of others. He's fully happy with it. And hopefully you aren't so unfortunate. I mean, there are human beings like that. They really do enjoy. They really get off on inflicting suffering on other people. Generally, we don't run into people like that, but there are human beings like that. With the devil, it's that exponentially. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I just was curious. You know, the thing that always was a question in my mind, why did demons ask to be, you know, go into the swine and then charge down the hill and go into the ocean? I mean, it just seems like...
Well, because what happens is these demons start operating in these pigs, and it evidently, you know, pigs aren't rational. All of a sudden there's something operating in them that they don't know, they don't understand, and they're just terrified by it. It just, in other words, whatever the demons are doing in, they can't possess. Possession involves the will. You know, they don't have wills, they don't have minds. But evidently there's some way that they can operate in an animal, but you see the effects, it doesn't last very long. It terrifies these poor animals, and they all just commit suicide. They all just kill themselves. So it just sort of floods whatever their instinctive, whatever their instinctive programming is, just gets, you know, overloaded. Maybe that's a way to put it. But remember, what you're seeing here is self-destructive behavior. What's happening with the pigs is just happening real fast. But this guy, these demoniacs, they're already living in a self-destructive way. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, We had a question in our group, what happened to the spirits after they went into the ocean? Because the pigs died, but did the spirits die?
Spirits can't die,
right?
Because they're immaterial. So then they're just kicked back to hell. Either that or, you know, remember our Lord's parable of the seven spirits who are they're exercised from a man, but they come back and bring their friends. So the idea is that potentially they're back in hell, but potentially they're sort of out there, hovering around, waiting for an opening. Now, even though that sounds spooky, again, to quote from St. Alphonsus Liguori will say that you have to remember that the devil is a dog on a leash. And the only way he's going to bite you is if you get too close to the leash. But, of course, easier said than done, isn't it? Because to open yourself to sin, and especially to serious sin, you're approaching the leash. And it's not to say that all people who sin seriously are opening themselves up to demonic possession, but certainly influence in the sense that he's sort of making little dents in your soul or making little inroads in. Remember, possession is a rare and a special case. More often than not, a devil doesn't need to go to that extreme. All that he needs from you is that your will is turned against God. That's all he needs. Demonic possession is like a cherry on the top, but all he needs from you is that your will is fixed in the wrong direction. And that's enough for him. Go ahead.
Why did they ask to be put into the swine?
Because they want to operate somewhere else.
Knew that Jesus was going to...
Oh yeah, he's going to throw them out.
Take them out of the man.
Yep. And that's what what you see with Jesus is the way that an exorcism works. It's a series of commands. You are commanding by God's power for the evil spirit to let go of the will. Because that's what's, maybe when you think of a possession, you think of it almost like the devil is a kind of a liquid and the person's a container and the liquid's in the container. And you can't think about it that way. You can't think of it in terms of imagination. Maybe a better image would be the way that an alcoholic, that somehow that desire for alcohol has a hold on that person, right? To be in the habit of being out of control, to be addictive, right? Is that there is something that has a hold of you, and you can't let go. You can't get through ordinary effort. You can't pull it away. So what's involved in a demonic possession is there's a way in which that possessing spirit has a hold of the will. That the will has opened itself. So there's a book out. I don't know that I can recommend it because it's simply so dark. Hostage to the Devil. And it's about five documented cases of possession and exorcism. And in each case, what the person did was open their will in some way to a possessing spirit. So one was a guy who was involved in New Age kind of spirituality. One was a cult. But all of these involved some kind of opening of the will in an occult way. Remember in The Exorcist, which is fictional, Reagan opens her will through playing around with the Ouija board. But when William Peter Blatty wrote the book, he based it on a real exorcism and a real possession, which happened in 1949, started in Iowa, ended at St. Louis University. And basically it was a 10-year-old boy, not a girl, and he had opened himself up to the spirit because his grandmother was a spiritualist. Remember that? This is the turn of that late 1800s, early 1900s. You get four people around a table, Uncle Cuthbert, are you there? Right? Trying to get a hold of their relatives. Well, that's what her grandmother was into. And she would teach her grandson about talking to the spirits and so on. Grandma dies. The grandson keeps trying to get in touch with his grandmother the way that she taught him. And a spirit shows up claiming to be grandma. And it wasn't her. So when you look at cases of possession, they tend to be things like that. It's not just people are bad and they have habits of mortal sin and they get possessed. No, there is some kind of actual opening to an evil spirit. And in a pagan society, you know, it's not hard to imagine that you'd have ways of that happening. Remember in the Acts of the Apostles, you have this girl who has a pythonical spirit. And evidently this spirit is giving out kind of like fortune information, and the people who are around this girl make money from this. So it's not hard to imagine how this girl got possessed as part of, again, some kind of pagan ritual. Well, we're over time, so it's we can continue with some of this, you know, next time if there's more you want to ask, and otherwise we'll move on. We'll finish 5 and go on to 6. Very good. Thank you.